Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
I coalesce the vapor of human experience into a viable and logical comprehension.
That's Frankenstein.
Is anybody got a dime?
Der Schwartz.
I am Frau Blücher.
I'm not going into the toilet. I'm going into show business.
Zipper neck.
I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
Bialystok in blue. Bialystok in blue.
Now listen to me very carefully. Don't put the candle back.
Welcome to Young Blazing Producers. While that may sound like a Fine Young Cannibals tribute band, it's actually the name of our recurring segment on the films of the great Mel Brooks. Milwaukee author Patrick McGilligan has written the biography Funny Man, Mel Brooks. He'll serve as our very own Igor.
Now it's pronounced Igor.
Well, I guess I was wrong then, wasn't I? Today's installment is Brooks's directorial debut, The Producers. McGilligan talks about the groundbreaking comedy that became a Broadway hit and how Mel came up with the idea.
In the book, I write about where the idea for The Producers came from, and it comes from disparate places. And there had been, in fact, other films about producers who were scurrilous, making money off of their investors and deliberately taking losses and sometimes channeling them to gangsters, etc. Mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of sort of predecessors. And I think one of the things about Mel and his work, which is important, interesting, and distinct, is that almost all of his work is a pastiche of something else or borrowed from something else. He had all these boyhood enthusiasms in song and Broadway and in films, and he followed them along and in various ways poaches from them in work after work. Sometimes it's, you know, quite obvious when it's Robin Hood or Young Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
And other times with The Producers, it's more obscure and you have to untangle the sources. But literally, The Producers had about 10 years of a gestation in his brain during the last days of his first marriage. He woke his wife up one night and showed her a yellow pad with the first scribbled words of what was then going to be, in its early stages, a novel set in England about producers. And then a long period of time went by during which he began to think of it as a Broadway play, ironically, because it becomes a Broadway play, you know, in the third act of his life.
Yeah.
And he worked very hard at that for a while, but it really took, and this is often true of Brooks, it took a collaborator to come along and really help him put it together almost 10 years after he had first started it. He hadn't completed it. He had not completed anything original of his own. He started working on The Producers with an unsung muse who was his typist and also who contributed a lot to editing and sometimes material in the script.
Yeah, Alpha Betty Olson.
Alpha Betty Olson.
Tell me a bit about her and the important role that she played in helping Mel create this film.
Well, there is an Alpha Betty Olson behind most of Mel's films, meaning there's unsung collaborators and very important contributors who, in the case of Alpha Betty, don't get credited, and she didn't get credited at all for The Producers. She was happy for the job. She loved Mel and thought he was hilarious. She was a very bright New Yorker who had spent time in college in the Midwest and then went back because she was in love with show business and struck up an acquaintance with Mel in the early 1960s at one of these house parties during the summer out on the islands. They became very friendly, and she became his muse on quite a few projects. Very funny, smart, serious writer who had not really the same drive and ambition to blaze her name in the sky the way Mel does, which really worked for him, and was happy to serve for a while as his muse and as his typist and as his secret helper.
The two main characters in The Producers are the Broadway producer Max Bialystok and the accountant Leopold Bloom. How did Mel Brooks come up with these two characters?
Some people would say it was two sides of the ego, the one outsized, flamboyant, acting out, the extrovert, and the other, the introvert. And Mel would sometimes say they were both sides of him.
Don't you see, Bloom, darling Bloom, glorious Bloom? It's so simple. Step one, we find the worst play in the world, a surefire flop. Step two,
I raise $1 million. A lot of little old ladies in the world. Step three, you go back to work on the books. Phony lists of backers, one for the government, one for us. You can do it, Bloom. You're a wizard. Step four, we open on Broadway. And before you can stay, step five, we close on Broadway. Step six, we take our $1 million, we fly to Rio de Janeiro.
So Gene plays the kind of sheepish, reticent, shy, bookwormish accountant, and Zero Mostow is the lecherous, scheming, greedy producer.
No, hey, Gene, what's the matter with you?
I'm hysterical. I'm having hysterics. I'm hysterical. I can't stop when I get like this. I can't stop. I'm hysterical. I'm wet. I'm wet. I'm hysterical and I'm wet.
How did Mel do as a director?
Even though he had seen every film ever made, it took him a while to sort of get into the role of the director. He would be very upset if people followed the script without improvising sometimes, and vice versa, very upset if they improvised without following the script. But he liked improvisation because he usually cast the kind of people who would bring a little extra to the scenes as he had written them. He could be very, very tyrannical and screaming. And he wasn't, like I say, planning. And, you know, he was nervous. On the first take, he called cut. The cameraman and the producer pulled him aside and very kindly explained to him that you say action. Look, it could have been a joke and it could be apocryphal and it also could be true because he was very nervous. There were a lot of nerves on that production and there were a lot of showdowns between Brooks and Zero Mostow, Brooks and his producer, et cetera, et cetera. That energy, that sort of frenetic energy, and the sort of lack of conventional approach in both the camera work and the staging really makes the film stand out.
Mm-hmm. And as you say in your book, impromptu decisions resulted in some of the fondly remembered highlights of the film. Can you give an example?
They made many, many impromptu decisions. And again, Alpha Betty Olson was acting as his assistant. She was running around trying to figure out how to do this, that, and the other thing to make things work. For example, Mel was a great enthusiast of Moss Hart, who had been his friend. They were going to do a My Fair Lady song as an audition for Hitler, which is kind of funny. They couldn't afford the rights. So Alva Betty is running around trying to figure out another song. And she goes to Lincoln Center to look up music. And she sees the fountain spurting up into the air, as it does periodically. And she thought, oh my gosh, this would be a good climax for the movie. Because they needed a new climax. Because Mel had written a climax where they are on the roller coaster at Coney Island. And suddenly it drops just as they strike the bargain. But the roller coaster hadn't been used for years. It was abandoned. And it would have cost too much to get it up and get it going again. She killed two birds with one stone by having this idea while she was at Lincoln Center looking for another song. Took Mel there. He looked at the fountain and great. So that's the, you know, that's the moment where they strike their bargain and jump around and are very happy that they're going to be successful, greedy producers making money off of all their investors by producing a surefire loss.
I want everything I've ever seen in the movies.
Leo, say you'll join me.
I'll do it. My God, I'll do it.
And they cut out the Moss Hart song. They had to. And that led to this marvelous sequence, which was pretty improvised, of all these actors that they brought in from around Broadway who tried out for Hitler in the movie. And it's a kind of a montage of auditions, which is very, very funny.
Thank you, Mr. Bing.
The little wooden boy.
Beautiful dream, Hawkeye.
Oh, does that mean that
I'm
I don't
sorry.
Get... You're sorry.
I'm curious, what do you think of the musical version of the producers?
I mean, the problem with the producers, the film, and the property, as you watch it today, is that so much Nazi humor has gone by the boards,
yes.
Including so many Hitler imitations. And Nazis and Hitler are very, very important to Mel's sense of humor. Always were behind the scenes, and then in his films eventually pretty much of a constant. By the time it turns up on Broadway in the early 2000s, it's tasteful in our culture, and it becomes kind of a smooth return to oldies that you loved. As such, it's great and was a tremendous hit.
The producers also served as an arc for season 4 of Larry David's HBO series, Curb Your Enthusiasm. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, it was great because on Curb Your Enthusiasm in that particular season, you know, this was before Anne's diagnosis, I believe, her second diagnosis. So you really see the two of them together on screen in this very, very funny setup of Larry David being scouted as one of the two leads to replace the leads on Broadway.
Yeah.
And Mel and Annie scheming for Larry David in order to shut down the show, certain that Larry David would be a big flop,
yeah.
Which is a very, very funny premise. And then you see the two of them, which is very nice, in this sort of carefree comic mode, playing themselves.
Did you see the look on their faces when Larry David forgot every line he He went up in smoke.
Oh, God, I'm so glad. I'm so thankful, thank God, that this damn play is going to be over. We're going to get our lives back.
He has freed us from the anchor, from the albatross of the producers, which has invaded our lives every single minute, every hour of every day.
Trapping us.
No more openings in Cleveland. No more sleeping in dirty beds in Pittsburgh. We're free. Free.
How was the producers received by the public and the critics when it was released?
Mel always claimed that there was some dissension among the critics because sometimes the dissension was in the same review. A critic would say, this movie really, really made me laugh except for the really tasteless parts that made me cringe. Even the reviews that were bad usually said, but I really laughed hard, you know.
Yeah.
So people criticized the direction, which they didn't think was smooth and professional and cinematic. And as I'm telling you, it really isn't and wasn't. It became a cult film almost instantly among certain clientele, including young people on college campuses. And it was nominated for and won an Academy Award for Best Script. So that's really pretty hard to beat.
Patrick McGilligan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Patrick McGilligan is the author of Funny Man, Mel Brooks. Find out more about Patrick and the producers at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Stephen Wright, Faith Pennick, and Patrick McGilligan. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Well, my friends call me LSD.
Our executive producer, nay, showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
Let's assume just for the moment that you are a dishonest man.
Assume away.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
That's it, baby, when you got it! Launch it! Launch it!